Welcome to Clareton Conversation. Our guest today is Julie Anderson. Julie is a chair of trustees of Clapham Writers. It's the charitable organization that's been responsible for bringing us the Clapham Book Festival, an annual celebration of books and writing in South London. Her own work has appeared in a number of academic courses, and she blogs occasionally reporting on current cultural, literary, and political events, writing, and publishing. For 4 years, she edited the Story Bazaar, an annual series of articles and short fiction by various contributors to the Story Bazaar website. Welcome, Julie.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you here, and I'm particularly, because we're coming up very quickly on the 2019 Clapham Book Fest, which I'm looking forward to. What day does it start again?
It's the 5th of October, Saturday the 5th of October, and it's at Omnibus Theatre, which is on north side of Clapham Common.
And give us a teaser here. You know, I've got as a publisher myself, I've got a passion for books. So tell me, who have you got coming to speak to us?
Well, we've got quite a varied programme. It's a good mix between fiction and non-fiction. So we start, for example, at 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon with Professor Kate Williams, who's Professor of History at Reading University, but also very well known as a TV historian. You've probably seen her commenting on all things royal.
Oh, she kind of like, who's that Cambridge University professor, the lady with the long grey hair that I'm so...
Mary Beard.
Mary Beard. Is she like Mary Beard?
Sort of, but as a younger version.
A younger version. I love Mary Beard, yeah. So I'm going to love this lady. What's her area of specialty?
Well, she writes, she is particularly interested in women in history. And her output thus far has concentrated on queens. So she did a very well-received book on Queen Victoria. Her current book is called Rival Queens, and it's about the relationship between Elizabeth I of England and Mary, Queen of Scots.
Always a good one, I have to say. Always yeah. Fascinating. That's there was a movie recently about the two of them.
Well, there was the Mary, Queen of Scots movie, that's yeah. Right. Though Kate wasn't the historical advisor on that. What is interesting is that she's actually got access to papers from the Royal Collection that haven't been made available before.
Interesting.
So finding all sorts of documents written by both Elizabeth and Mary themselves about their relationship.
But, you know, I think it's one of those timeless, you know, this kind of sibling rivalry. I mean, I appreciate the fact that they are cousins, but, you know, this it's not just fighting for a throne and it's not just fighting to survive, but the tensions that exist within a family for who's going to make it and who isn't. It's an absolutely classic story.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm looking forward to it because I've not heard her speak about this. I've shared a platform with her in the past talking about writing history and writing historical fiction, but I've not heard her talk about this book, which is more recent. She's very, very erudite and knowledgeable, but she wears it very lightly. She's great fun to listen to too.
Oh, I'm looking forward to going to see that.
Yeah.
And who else have you got?
Well, she kicks off the whole thing at 2 o'clock, and then at 3:30, we have Ursula Buchan, who is a prize-winning journalist in her own right, but she's also granddaughter of John Buchan, author of The 39 Steps.
Oh, I was going to say, The 39 Steps.
Absolutely. She's just written a biography of her grandfather using a lot of family archives.
Wasn't he originally South African or something, the family? Or, you know, hadn't they settled in Africa? And, well, I guess we'll find out. We'll go to her talk and we'll find out where the family comes from.
Absolutely. Don't confuse the Buchans with the Hannays. Of course, Richard Hannay is the hero of 39 Steps, and he comes from South Africa.
Oh, there we go. That'd be me mixing the two up. You're absolutely
not,
correct.
Possibly not. Yeah. Though, interestingly, as a Canadian, John Buchan actually became Governor General of Canada.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yes.
Which I didn't know until, you know, I was talking to Ursula.
I think it's hilarious.
He did so much. I mean, he didn't just write the 39 Steps. Nobody knows anything else that he wrote, as far as I can judge. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure some people do because they're great fans, but the general public just know John Buchan, 39 Steps. But he wrote 40 or 50 other books, articles, essays, etc. He was a journalist.
God, can you imagine being that prolific?
Incredibly prolific. Yeah. He was apparently a much-loved Governor General of Canada. They gave him a state funeral when he died.
Oh, well, so. I'm definitely going to, as a Canadian, I'm definitely going to have to go to that too. And who else? Have you got a keynote speaker in the evening or anything?
We have. Our keynote speaker is Frank Gardner, OBE, who is the current BBC security correspondent. Though I think he's also quite well known for his being a war correspondent. I mean, he's the chap who was very badly injured and is now in a wheelchair.
Right.
But he's continued, obviously not as a war correspondent, because it's quite difficult.
Sure.
But he is the BBC security correspondent and is regularly seen on the box. And he's coming along to talk to Simon Burthon, who is also someone who lives in Clapham, who's a filmmaker and writer, who writes thrillers, as indeed does Frank Gardner, or has become a thriller writer. What I will find very interesting about that, as a person who's trying to write a thriller herself, mm-hmm. is how he uses what he knows from his life, being a war correspondent and then a security correspondent, and how he uses that in writing his thrillers, which are very much sort of espionage-based. So that will be quite interesting in itself, seeing how the life transfers into the art.
Well, we could talk about this... because I love literary festivals, and I love how they're emerging as a way of finding new audiences for books and getting people out meeting authors who are notoriously recluse or notorious at kind of being a bit antisocial, getting them out meeting the public. So we're gonna circle back to this topic.
Yeah.
Because I'm afraid it's going to hijack our conversation otherwise if we stay on it. And what I'm really interested in is to talking about you, Julie. How is it that you came to be organising the Clapham Book Fest?
Well, I was a senior civil servant for many years, and I took early retirement like many others, and then decided that I would like to do what I always had a passion for, which was writing. I then discovered that Clapham is really a sort of hotbed for writing and writers. There are so many of us. I kept bumping into the same people all the time promoting books. And a little research revealed that Clapham has had writers living and working here way back into the 16th century. We even had a Clapham writer on the Mayflower, would you believe, Edward Wilmslow, who was the second governor of Virginia. And he still wrote letters home from abroad, you know, back to Clapham. But there are some very, very, very famous people. So novelists, Graham Greene, for example, lived on the north side of the Common, wrote The Ministry of Fear while he was living here, set The End of the Affair on the Common. Angela Carter.
Angela Carter lived here?
Yep. Angela Carter, frequently seen taking the air by Clapham Common tube station, just that little bit of the Common there.
Yes.
But also more recent people, people like Roald Dahl, for example.
I didn't know Roald Dahl lived here.
Yep. He lived here. He had a muse house where he used to come to write.
I didn't know that at all.
Yeah.
Because we went up to the Roald Dahl Museum when the kids were little, which is north of London in one of the leafy suburbs. Mm-hmm. And saw his garden shed that he wrote in there, which was very much maintained in this all kind of shabbiness. It everything, nothing looks fancy in his writing shed, I have to say.
Yeah.
I had no idea that. I have to tell you, the Roald Dahl Museum made absolutely no mention of Clapham when I was there.
Well, he had a muse house. He wasn't here for long. If you go along the north side and turn down the main road that goes to Battersea,
mm-hmm.
I think it's called the Chase.
Yes, yes.
There's a row of muse houses off to the right,
mm-hmm.
That were once the stables to the big houses that fronted onto the Common. I mean, they were very shabby, I think, when he occupied one. I suspect he occupied one of them in a much earlier time than he had a nice house in Buckinghamshire or
yes,
wherever it was.
Yes.
But yes, he did live there and he did write while he was there, as indeed did Noel Coward, the playwright. He lived in Clapham. E.M. Forster was baptised in Holy Trinity Church. Samuel Pepys died in Clapham, just off the north side of the Common. And there are also less perhaps salubrious ones. Sax Rohmer, creator of Fu Manchu, lived on Clapham's south side.
Everybody's kung fu fighting.
I know, but the list is sort of endless, really.
And why do you think that is, Julie? Why do you think they've come to Clapham?
Well, I think I have a theory. It's interesting. One of the very first sessions in the very first Clapham Book Festival was a discussion called Place and the Writer, and it was about how the imagination is stimulated by place. And that was involving myself, Elizabeth Buchan, who is a best-selling novelist who lives in Clapham, and Matt Beaumont, who's Clapham born and bred, and he's professor at UCL history, and he's just written a wonderful history of London called Night Walking. And we were talking about why it was so many writers settled in Clapham, even before it was part of the City of London, the grander City of London. And we came to the conclusion that it's something to do with having the common at the heart of it. It's that big open space that invites imagination and transgression.
Indeed.
And Clapham has never been an establishment place. It is now the home of bankers, as it was indeed in the 18th century. But it's always been a place where, you know, highwaymen have roamed the common, where there are perhaps more insalubrious, up-to-date instances of people getting arrested on the common.
I'm not even going to touch that one, Julie. let's not name names. But, it's always various MPs. You're right, though. Well, you know, if an MP gets caught, it's here.
It's Clapham Common, absolutely. Yeah. And Clapham was once well known as a place to keep one's mistress. Apparently, yes, Chelsea Barracks just over the river.
Yes, I suppose. I mean, it's close enough to the West End, close enough to Kensington, Belgravia, but far enough away that you can guarantee your wife won't ever bump into your mistress.
Absolutely. So we formulated this theory that actually it's the open space at the heart of Clapham that invites all sorts of transgression and imagination.
Oh, I like that.
And that's why writers come and settle in Clapham.
Although now I'm feeling a bit boring because all I do is walk my dog around it.
When you can, when there aren't events on it. I mean, that's the other thing, I guess.
Well, so Julie, you left the civil service to become a full-time writer.
That's right.
And you have published now 3 books?
Yes, I wrote 2 adventure novels for young adults, though actually they seem to be liked as much by adults as young adults.
So they're crossover literature.
They are, yeah.
Tell us a bit about them.
Well, they run one into another. They're set in 13th century southern Spain in what was known at that time as Al-Andalus. It was a place that was...
Now known today as what, Andalusia, I'm guessing?
Andalusia, yes.
Yeah. So the 1200s, like why would... The 1200s, why would you set anything in the 1200s? Like, what was going on then that would make this, speaking about place, a time and a place, like, why?
Well, it's part of the reconquest of Spain by the Christians, because Al-Andalus was the great nation of Moorish peoples.
Are we talking Granada here?
Yeah, well, Granada is one of them. Granada was that part of Al-Andalus which stood out for the longest against the Christians. They only capitulated to Ferdinand and Isabella in 1492. But it was much earlier than that the Christian princes from the north tried to reinvade the Iberian Peninsula and take back control.
To be specific, the Christian princes from the north, are we talking what, English, German, French? Are we talking about Northern Spanish?
Largely Northern Spanish and Southern French.
Okay.
So the Christian kingdoms of Leon, Castile.
So this is a land grab, essentially?
Essentially, yes. I mean, it's wrong to underestimate the role that religion played in everyday life.
It's always wrong to underestimate the role of religion.
And so I think would not be entirely right to say that there was no piety involved. And indeed, Alfonso X, who was the leader of the Christian forces in the 13th century, eventually was given crusader status by the Pope. However, not at the time of the novels that I write. But it was also, it was politics. So you have Christian knights fighting on the side of Muslim cities, because that's where they're from.
Oh, I see, yes. So they're fighting for their homeland.
Well, basically, yeah, because Al-Andalus was quite tolerant, in 13th century terms, was a very tolerant society, tolerant of other religions. So you still had, even though it was a Moorish country, or series of city-states, which it had become by that time, it was very much a power which allowed, which had tolerance of religion, in essence. You paid your taxes. You had to pay slightly more if you were a Christian or a Jew, but that was essentially the difference that life made to you. You just paid a little bit more.
Yes, it is frequently evoked about the possibility, you know, when, as we struggle to move forward in the 21st century with globalization and multiculturalism and diversity, which is already a fait accompli, near as I can determine, the city-states, the Moorish city-states of Spain, are evoked as a very reasonable way that it can be done.
Well, I think there is a specific Spanish word for it, which is convivencia.
What is it?
Convivencia, which means quite literally living together or living with each other.
Oh, convivencia.
Convivencia.
I kind of like that. Congress.
Almost, yes. But it's...
Cohabitation.
Cohabitation. It's... I mean, it wasn't perfect by any manner of means. We're talking about the 13th century, so, you know...
No, for heaven's sakes, yeah.
You know, women were second-class citizens. Slavery was common. You know, it's not a perfect society we're talking about. But in terms of different religions living together and getting on with each other, for most of the time, it wasn't bad at all. So you, but you then have this invasion of southern Spain from by the Christians, who were much more, I suppose we would call them fundamentalist now. But you were quite right to say it was a land grab too. I mean, it's just a political way of increasing power and land.
And well, it's a coincidence of interest, isn't it?
It's a
coincidence of interest.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
which has got its own synergy. You know, it just happens to be both godly and enriching at the same time.
Yes.
Which is very convenient.
It's extremely convenient. And that was taking place in the 13th century. And it was taking place in the area in which I set the books, because I have a home in Jerez de la Frontera in southern Spain. And in 1264, there was the Siege of Jerez, which is the point at which my first book opens.
Wow, it sounds really interesting. And you self-published those.
I did.
But you're now moving towards writing something for a publishing company, namely mine.
Yes, Claret Press.
Yeah. Now tell us a bit about your forthcoming book with Claret Press, okay. Which, by the way, I know you may think I'm biased, but it's a very exciting, fantastic book. So tell us a bit about it.
Well, it's a contemporary thriller, so it's as far away from southern Spain in the 13th century as you can imagine, in one sense. But in another, it is called Plague. and it's set in contemporary London, in Whitehall. So it's a world I know very well, having worked in Whitehall for 27 years. And it's essentially a book about power. The theme is power and what happens when a democracy forgets, perhaps, to safeguard some of its basic tenets.
And this is exactly the kind of books I love, is books that remind me of the important truths, the eternal truths, but are also a page-turning thriller. It's going to be a great read. I'm looking forward to it coming out. I'm looking forward to the party, too.
Well, yeah, we'd have to have it in the House of Commons, I think, you know, on the terrace or something like that.
I like that idea, yeah. Absolutely. And what brought you to a life of writing? I always ask my guests to say one, at least one, some people break the rules and bring in more than one, one work of art that inspired them to engage in this very perilous journey, perhaps not as perilous as being in Andalusia during the time of the conquest or the reconquest, but something that really changed their lives. What was it for you?
Well, I knew that you were going to ask this question, and I thought about it. And I'm a writer, so I thought, well, it ought to be a book. But then I couldn't settle on any single book. I mean, should it be an adventure story? I've been writing, you know, historical adventure stories. So should it be The Riddle of the Sands or The Three Musketeers or any of those?
Treasure Island.
Yeah, absolutely. But then I thought, no, perhaps it ought to be some of the works that I really enjoyed that I go back to, like, you know, T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets or that sort of thing. But actually, I wanted to cheat in the end. And so, especially given that we were talking about place earlier, this rather fits. My work of art is a place. It's a library.
A library. Fantastic. I love that. Yeah, and I'm just going to slightly make a sideways comment that voters are inspired by different things that acts as the muse, if you wish, the motivating impulse. Mm-hmm. P.D. James, for instance, has claimed that all her fantastic best-selling, internationally renowned books are inspired by a sense of place. Yes. And she builds a plot around place. So it sounds like this is also what's inspiring you. So tell us about this library that so inspired you.
Well, I was born in, I wasn't actually born, but I grew up in a semi-rural village in Worcestershire, as it then was. And it had a fine old church, it had a Methodist chapel, it had a Victorian park, and it had a library. and the library was in a converted shop. It was an old Victorian shop. So it was a double-fronted shop with glass windows, floor to ceiling, and a door in the middle, which would at some point have had a bell. Because even as a child, I realised that the door ought to have a bell.
Right.
And inside its floor, which was, it all smelt sort of slightly fusty and musty.
And as all good libraries should,
absolutely,
I have to say.
Absolutely. It had a wooden floor, partly covered by linoleum, and an enormous wooden desk behind which the librarians would stand, which I realised later on, of course, was the old shop counter.
Right.
And that's where they would keep all the stamps and the tickets and the whatever. And you could see the stacks of books, the ends of the stacks of books through the windows outside. Mm-hmm. But it was always a very quiet place. And I mean, the librarians were constantly trying to encourage children and indeed adults to join reading groups and do this and do that.
Even in those days?
I didn't want any of that. I just wanted my books. I wanted my fix. I wanted to get as many books as I possibly could on any one trip and then disappear into them for as long as I could manage. And anything and everything. You know, I read rubbish, as well as classics.
Yes,
but I had to read. There's a very fascinating book by Frances Spofford called "The Child That Books Built," which is not unlike my relationship with books when I was a child. Mm-hmm. And he touches on child and literacy development through books, and you can, you know, talk around this subject forever, you know, Bruno Bettelheim, the uses of enchantment, all that mm-hmm. sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I ever left the wood in that series of you know, progressions that children go through from you know, forest to wood to socialization out in the world, etc., etc. I think that deep in my heart of hearts, I'm still in the wood. I'm still reading in the wood. I've not become a social being at all. I do that outwardly, but really I'm back in the forest.
So the real Julie Anderson is a bit shy, got her nose stuck in the book.
Absolutely.
And this Julie Anderson we see out there organising the Clapham Book Festival, she's a new persona you've kind of stapled on the front of the real Julie.
Well, I don't know. All of us have lots of versions of us, I guess.
And, yes, I suppose so.
And those are two of mine, I suspect. I also like the prevalence of forests and woods and everything. I mean, you know, fairy stories have woods.
Yeah.
Dante in Nozze del Cammin di Nostra Vita. You know, it's the wood is a wonderful trope.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And it's a metaphor for many things. Mm-hmm. And a magical, I think, especially in this country, because your forests here, your woods here are quite literally, you know, enchanting is what we're talking mm-hmm. about. You're enchanting forests out of the Forest of Dean, for instance,
yeah,
and Epping Forest. Yeah. They're quite special. You know, I'm saying this coming from Canada, where we have mile upon mile upon mile upon mile of just endless, you know, thousands and thousands of miles of pine, birch. Mm. But here, I think the forests have got something more powerful. What you don't have in the sheer square kilometers, you make up for in twisted, gnarly roots and low-hanging boughs and abundant dark corners. And it's a bit magical here.
Mm. It's interesting. I mean, I was reading relatively recently, and I can't remember the name of the book, by Simon Sharma, a book about landscape and imagination. And he was writing very eloquently about the German concept of the forest, mm-hmm. and how it's influenced German art from, physical art through literature up until very recently, in very modern art, when people are still referencing, the heart of the forest as an important place.
Well, I think one of the things that about the forests in, especially in a more medieval pre-industrial era from which this would emerge, is that they're quite dark.
Yes.
In the northern climates,
yes.
These are dark forests.
Yes, they are.
Whereas here you've got deer that open up into glades, and you've got the yew trees creating empty circles in the middle where light can reach, and we tend not to have that in the north.
Yeah.
So the woods are literally darker.
Yes, absolutely, and I think that's right. So you have this sort of concept almost of this sort of Arthurian forest, the enchanted forest, certainly, where I mean Hansel and Gretel go into a Germanic wood.
Mm-hmm.
If Hansel and Gretel went into a wood in that sort of courtly English sense, they'd sort of end up, being part of a community of roe deer or something. they wouldn't sort of stumble upon the Wicked Witch.
Yes, very interesting. And of all the things that you've contributed to the artistic world, is the Clapham Book Fest you're most proud of?
I suppose so. It's very difficult to be proud of it when you're knee deep in doing things for it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yes.
I'll be proud of it when it's delivered this year. It's not delivered yet. Yes, I guess so. I mean, it didn't exist before, and now it does. So
congratulations on that, by the way.
Thank you.
Someone who set up a publishing company from nothing. I know that it's no small achievement. What you have done is put together a literary festival and made it increasingly part of the social agenda here in Clapham and South London. So that's no small accomplishment. Mm. And it's an enormous gift to the community and to writers. So.
Well, I hope so. One of the things that we hoped to do when we started it was to highlight, the number of writers who've lived and work in Clapham.
Yeah.
We have got local writers this year at the festival. When I was talking to you about John Buchan earlier,
yes.
Ursula Buchan, his granddaughter, is talking to Elizabeth Buchan, who is her sister-in-law. But she lives in Clapham and she's a best-selling novelist. She's just bought out a new book, The Museum of Broken Promises, which was very well reviewed in the Times this week. And also Henry Hemming, who's talking about his latest book, which is Our Man in New York. He had a double spread in the Mail on Sunday, I think.
Golly, fantastic. I'm so deeply envious.
Well, yeah. How they manage it, it's the publishers, I guess.
Yeah.
Both of those, I think, are published by Corvus, which is quite interesting. But so Henry's coming along to talk about his book.
And what do you think is driving this kind of mushroom up of literary festivals? Because Clapham has one, Balham's got one, which is, three blocks down the road from us.
Yep.
Dulwich has one, which is three blocks in the other direction. Mm. Okay, maybe six, but you got the idea. Yeah. They're just kind of springing up out of nowhere, and they all seem to be doing relatively well, like all things considered. I mean, the Wimbledon Book Festival is absolutely huge now.
Yes, it is. I mean, Dulwich and Balham are essentially run by the same person, which is a lady called Susie Nicklin, who runs Dulwich Books.
Yeah.
Who does both the Dulwich Festival and the Balham Festival. So one is a sort of extension of the other. Wimbledon's been around for a bit longer. And we've been around, this is our fourth year. So we're a new kid on the block, although Balham, you see, is actually even newer. That's a sort of extension of Dulwich, which is about the same vintage as us.
And what do you think is driving this?
Well, I think part of it is just interest in books. Either not necessarily the paper version. I mean, some people prefer to read on an e-reader now. I don't personally, but others do. And, you know, people are just very interested in reading. If you think of the huge cultural impact of something like the big commercial successes, so Harry Potter or Wolf Hall, Margaret Atwood's The Testaments is coming out this week with a massive launch at the National Theatre. I mean, the British skyline is now lit up because the sort of new brutalist architecture of the National Theatre is now having pictures of her handmaids projected upon it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's partly that that books, or some books, have become so commercially successful that they've appropriated large chunks of sort of the artistic or cultural landscape, if you like. And that means that people get involved and people read books that perhaps they wouldn't have read before, and then they read other books. So
I hope so. I also think that we are swamped with information in our day and age. Mm. We're swamped with books. Mm. Should you be reading Margaret Atwood or watching the TV series The Handmaid's Tale?
Yeah.
Should you? I mean, there's only so many hours in the day, and so you need something that almost acts as a catalyst or something to propel you into reading a book, and you think, okay, then I'll read that book. Mm. Like, it assists you in making choices.
I think that's true. And you know, you may start out by watching the TV version of The Handmaid's Tale and then go to the book, but then you will read, you know, The Blind Assassin. Mm. Or
which one, by the way, just the Booker Prize,
yes,
about 22 years ago,
yeah, something like that,
yeah. Was it 23 years ago, 24 years ago? Don't hold me to that, okay? If my dates could be wrong.
I'm not sure. But I mean, any of Margaret Atwood's output. I mean, her speculative fiction like Oryx and Crake, for example, mm-hmm. which then might lead you into science fiction. So it's all stimulus, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm. It's all grist for the mill.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the interesting ways we communicate to each other is through books. Mm. The difference, I think, that has been brought home to me about things like literary festivals and book festivals is that suddenly you realize that books are a social entity.
Yes.
They bring people together to discuss things. Mm. They're not singular. Now, this might contradict the true Julie Anderson who lives inside the pages of her book and doesn't want to engage with groups. But here's the contradiction. You have then created a mechanism, an institution by which we can all come together.
And talk about books. Absolutely. And actually, that is one of the measures of success of many of the discussions at the Clapham Book Fest. Because, for example, last year we had a session between Mark Lawson of Radio 4, The Front Row, etc.
Yeah, The Front Row, yes.
And Vasim Khan, who writes the Inspector Chopra mysteries, which are set in Mumbai. And a more unusual pairing you would not come mm-hmm. across. Mm-hmm. And it was the genius of our programme director who put them together. And they ended up having, with indeed the audience, an amazing discussion about truth and finding out the truth and investigating and allegations and Me Too and a huge wide-ranging discussion between two extremely intelligent writers and people, and with people in the audience. And I was the sort of convener of that session, and I had to stop it and say, I'm terribly sorry, but we've got to go out of here now, because in 10 minutes' time there's going to be another discussion. And it went on outside. And
that's lovely. That's wonderful.
That was a wonderful, wonderful measure of success, actually. I mean, you know, the Julie Anderson with her head in a book halfway up a tree would have nothing to do with any of this. But of course, it's absolutely what you need in terms of stimulating ideas and imagination.
And I suppose the other question I'd just like to kind of slightly touch on, if we can. We live in a time of considerable turmoil, and I think it's more than just political. I think we're all grappling with what it is to belong to a global community, which we now are, whether we want to or not. Mm. And I'm wondering how much the arts can contribute to a greater understanding of that. What's your feeling?
Well, hugely, I think. The arts always have. There are political books, some of them hugely commercially successful, like House of Cards, for example.
Lovely example. Yeah.
Which seek to dissect the political world in terms of the institutions and its institutions and the people who use them in order to gain power. And also, I guess, there are the less overtly political but intrinsically political books, like Ali Smith's seasonal books, yes. When she's writing as things happen mm-hmm. and wants to capture the moment in political terms as well as in terms of nature, in terms of everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So I think sometimes it's overt, sometimes it's intrinsic, but it's always there.
Yes, I agree. It's this interplay between the world of ideas and art and the more concrete reality that we have to live in. I think is there's always a tension there between the two,
mm-hmm.
And I think the arts plays an undervalued, underappreciated role mm-hmm. in bringing this to everybody's attention.
Yes, well, absolutely, and I think too. I mean, something like books and reading is intrinsically democratic.
Yeah, that's a good way of describing it. Yeah,
in that, I you know, slave owners knew the power of reading and writing, which is why they didn't let their slaves learn how to read
mm-hmm.
and write.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mill owners didn't want to educate their workers.
Their working
class, because, you know, reading and writing empowers people.
It does.
And now mm-hmm. we're in a situation where political ideology doesn't recognise the value of imagination, inspiration, through
creativity.
And creativity. So, I mean, libraries are closing down all over Britain.
Oh, I think it's a travesty.
So, you know, I would recommend anyone listening to this podcast to go and on the bookseller's website and check out the Fight for Libraries campaign, because the only way that we're going to hold on to our libraries is if we fight to do just that.
Yeah. It just says, this just reminds me of something that when Booker T. Washington, the escaped slave who went to the northern United States and agitated for the abolition of slavery, they made such a big deal over how well-learned he was.
Mm.
A black man who can read and write.
Yes.
A black man who's this well-educated. And he speaks well. And he's written this and he's written that.
Mm.
And it was almost like kind of, you know, I'm turning this into a caricature, which is very unfair, but it's kind of Booker T. Washington, comma, a well-educated man,
yeah.
comma, able to speak more than one language, able to read and write. That was always what emerged in the pamphlets when they were describing him. That was his primary way of describing him,
right.
Was as a learned man.
Yes.
Because it just, you know, shattered any preconception you might have.
Mm.
Of the black person being unable to communicate.
And yet this also, as this is a very circular conversation, brings us back to Clapham and the church on the common, which was, of course, William Wilberforce's church, where the movement for the abolition of slavery began.
Could you just state, not everybody who listens to this might be British, and so they might not know very much about it. Do you know a little bit more, a few more details?
A little bit more, I guess. There is a very large and lovely galleried 18th century church on Clapham Common called the Church of the Holy Trinity, I believe.
What, in Clapham Common itself?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, Holy Trinity, yeah.
And that church, under its ministers, who were the Venn family, father and son, led a movement, an anti-slave movement, from the 18th century onwards, which included people whose names you can see on roads around Clapham now, and was led by a number of eminent individuals, one of which was William Wilberforce, MP. Who was a member of the congregation there. And it was he who began the legislative drive to abolish slavery, first of all in the British Empire and thereafter across the world. And he achieved it. And it was, it's the equivalent of taking on the giant corporate oil companies today. Mm-hmm. You know, there was just this little group of people who started on their campaign. And they believed they were right.
And changed the world.
And changed the world. And that's also something to do with living in Clapham, I think. You know, it doesn't matter what you actually do. If you look up at Holy Trinity and you think, well, you know, it's a bit small-minded to complain that you've got to organise volunteers for the Clapham Book Festival when you had a group of people up there who managed to change the entire world.
Puts our problems into perspective, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Yeah, and this sounds like a political party broadcast for Clapham. We want everybody to move here. It is a lovely, lovely place to live. And in that regard, we're both very lucky to live here and work out of here and be creators. We work in the creative industry here.
Mm, absolutely. And, you know, that's another reason why there are lots of writers who live here.
Yeah. So, Julius, I wish you the very, very best for the Clapham Book Festival starting October the 5th,
The 5th, yes, at Omnibus Theatre.
At Clapham Omnibus Theatre.
Yep.
I'm sure it's going to be another stellar success.
I do hope so. Yep. The tickets are available online at Omnibus.
Wonderful.
Or you can check out the ClaphamBookFestival.com website.
Lovely. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
My pleasure.
Claret and Conversation was brought to you by our sponsor, Clapham Publishing Services. It was executive produced, sound recorded, and edited by Teddy Ethoft. If you liked Clareton Conversation, please subscribe, share, and comment.